want to welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. You are listening to the All Ball Podcast, part of the Herd Podcast Network. You can check out the Doug Gottlieb Show daily from 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12:3 Pacific. Sirius XM 217 or 203. You can download the pod. You listen to it on the iHeartRadio app, on FoxSportsRadio.com, or in your Fox Sports Radio affiliate. Before we get to our guest this week, who is Adam Morrison, former National Player of the Year, and I'm going to just warn you, we just talked for however long this podcast is. We just talked. So there are some curse words if you have children in the car. It's not safe for work. I mean, it's not bad, but it's, you know, it's not the language that, you know, you're like pop in with your kid. Just know that this is how dudes talk, and it might not be cool with you. So I just want to make sure you give you a little heads up. Anyway, and you wait to hear the stories. Some Kobe stories, some Powell stories, some, what else was there? Phil Jackson, Larry Brown, Mark Few. Great stories. Amazing stuff. Amazing. Okay, so here's... let me just get to this Kevin Durant thing real quick. Like, I get that Kevin Durant wants to paint the picture of where he actually is in his life and how he really liked Oklahoma City and wanted to go back, but couldn't believe how bitter all those people were. And really liked Golden State and enjoyed winning a championship, but could never fit in there. But if you read all of these quotes, there's no like give back. Like there's no self-deprecation there. Right? Just like all you hear is, hey, I was different from those guys, and you know, I didn't need to buy into their culture because I'm not like a kid. I'm an adult. There's just so much pride there to not just admit, hey, I might not have fit in there. I probably could have done some things. It could have worked out differently. It didn't. But, you know, some of it's me and some of it's them. No. If you read Kevin Durant's quotes, they're all somebody else. And we all know as adults, that's not really the way it works. Any failed relationship I have, friendship wise or otherwise, it was some because of the other person, but there was a good portion of that was because of me. Any work relationship that ended, right? Some because of other people, it's some because of me. That's really growing up. And I think what happens is he thinks he's growing up by saying who he really is, and maybe it is, but man, Kevin Durant sounds miserable. Just does not sound like a dude that has a good time. And I understand that he doesn't love so many elements of what makes an NBA player, but it doesn't stop him from using those elements. Right? There's a contradiction there. I don't like social media. Why are you on social media all the time? I don't like the negativity of it. Then get off of it. No one forces you to. It does not change his bottom line at all. He's a multi-millionaire 10 times over, and probably will end up being a billionaire by the time he's done. He doesn't need social media to help him there. I don't love the negativity of social media either, but I do actually need it for what I do at work. He doesn't. So there's a weird contradiction there. Hey, I've spent the last 3 years telling you I think Kevin Durant's the best player in the NBA. But I'm going to have to spend the next 3 years saying, like, God, he's just a guy that struggles to fit in with other people. Just is. I'm not really sure the purpose of doing another sit-down interview other than to make yourself feel good and maybe to keep explaining yourself. But it's a lot like when you ever told a fib and you're explaining, and the more you explain yourself, the more you expose your fib. That kind of feels like Kevin Durant. Doesn't mean he's lying, but the more he talks, the less likable he actually is. And I think the reason he's talking is because he thinks it'll make him more likable.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Well, let's welcome into the All Ball Podcast the Naismith Memorial Player of the Year, also the Wooden Award Player of the Year in college basketball. He was the third overall pick of the 2003 NBA Draft and a hero to so many in the country. He's Adam Morrison. He joins us in the All Ball Podcast. Ammo, how are you?
Good, Doug. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay, your current location at this very moment is where?
Spokane, Washington, home of the Zags.
Are you in the bunker?
Do I have to clarify this one again? I do not own a bunker, but I am not in a bunker. I'm in my house. So No, I guess.
Yeah, of the urban myths about you, I would say the bunker is probably the most prominent one currently, right? Are there other urban myths about you?
I've heard them all. I've had some odd interactions with people as far as certain urban myths or certain things that people have said about me. So I guess the bunker one is the most prevalent one, but I had to do the podcast tour when it first happened, and I almost had to sue Kyle Wiltshire for it and blah, blah, blah. So, it's the fun stuff telling everybody that you're not a psycho. It gets interesting to say the least, but, I shot rifles for a while. It was kind of a hobby of mine, and, it's just kind of the subculture up here in the Northwest.
You also look. You have a family. I know you've posted stuff from a lake house. It feels like from the again and like social media is not always a direct parallel to what your real life is, right? A lot of us post things about our life, and then inside, we have all kinds of issues. How is your life? Like, to somebody who's going to ask you, how is your life?
It's good. I mean, I got three kids. My oldest is 11. An 8-year-old, and then I just had my son is 3, just turned 3 in August. I do games for Learfield IMG College for Gonzaga, play-by-play or color during the winter. So my summers are pretty free, pretty open. I get to be a dad. I coach my daughter's oldest daughter's AU team, play a lot of golf. I'm at the lake a lot. I bought a lake place in Coeur d'Alene about 5 years ago, so. My life's okay, I guess. I get to watch college basketball for a living and just be a dad.
Your dad was a basketball coach, right? And so when,
yes.
when you were born, that was he was in Montana. Was it Dawson Community College? Is that where he was then?
Yep.
When did you first, like, when did it first click? Like, this is what I want to do.
As far as hoops, his playing,
yeah.
I think just growing up as a kid and, really just being around the game constantly. I mean, you're a coach's kid, I believe,
yeah,
as well. So I was kind of brainwashed to be a player. And so I was just always around the gym. And, obviously it really helped my career. Just having that experience and kind of that extra knowledge, especially at a younger age, to be able to be successful. And, I was a gym rat growing up. And so, my skill development was a little bit higher than most kids at the time. And it really helped me, get a scholarship and, make it to the NBA.
Remind me, when was it you found out you were diabetic?
It was 14. I got really sick. I was in eighth grade. I got really sick, lost probably like 30 pounds, which obviously is a lot for, how thin my body type is in general, and especially at that age. Had to go to the hospital, was in the hospital for 4 or 5 days. Really didn't think I was going to be able to play sports at the time because the technology wasn't where it is now. And I was lucky I had a really good endocrinologist that really put me on the right path. And I kind of used it as a discipline to help me in athletics because, you have to be so controlled to be able to play. I'm at a high level. So I looked at it as a blessing looking back, but at the time it was very worrisome because, we just talked about, I was a gym rat. I was a coach's kid. I loved the game. And then all of a sudden, you're having to go to the hospital and tell you that you have to take shots, you're going to change your diet. There's just that fear of not knowing what's in the future health-wise. Again, like I said, I use it as a positive, and I tried to use it as a discipline, and it really, kind of changed my outlook as an athlete, even though I was only in eighth grade, of how you have to eat and how you have to be cognizant of how you treat your body. And so I think it later on helped me a little bit.
I think it helps a lot. I mean, like, here's my perspective. So my dad was type 2 diabetic,
mm-hmm.
and so he actually, when I was like he was like 50, so how old was I? I was like 10 when he became type 2 diabetic. Anyway, we basically started eating kind of his diet and staying away from things that were so high in sugars and and kind of ahead of the curve in terms of eliminating even complex carbohydrates, you know, from the diet, which now is the norm. And back then it was the exception. Like, again, you go to my high school days and the night before a game, like, go carbo load, right? Which you would never eat much pasta. Right? You'd never do now. But I do feel like, look, the way people are eating now, like, that's how I ate in high school. And people used to think it was crazy that we were eating avocados and meats and salads and whatever. I almost feel like, you know, look, in addition to your skill and to your brain, like, that probably ended up really helping you because you started to eat an athlete's diet before anybody else would.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I ate the same, you know, type of meal before every game since high school all the way to the NBA, you know, a long-lasting protein and then a solid carbohydrate like potato and then a green vegetable. Right. And you're exactly right.
That's what I had.
Some guys, some guys, you know, I got to the league and it was so funny because some guys would eat like pancakes and syrup and eggs and bacon before games. I'm like, how do these guys do it? And, you know, obviously they're God-given really good basketball players, but I think it really helped me down the line, definitely.
You show up at Gonzaga, a place where, you know, like, I think, what, fourth grade you moved there, right? Is that right?
Yep.
Fourth grade, yeah.
Yep.
So you show up at Gonzaga, you played at Meade. Everybody locally knew you, but nationally, we did not. Like, you know, Fuey would tell us, like, man, we got this really good local kid or whatever. What do you remember about your first kind of, your first time on campus as a Zag?
You know, I just remember what really helped me being a local kid was I was allowed to play pickup for about a year as a high schooler, you know, or, you know, 5 months before the season. And so I really got comfortable early. And then I had success during those pickup type of games. So then I kind of knew going in that I had a good chance of, because when they first recruited me, they told me they're going to gray shirt me, whatever that means. Because of the diabetes, everybody was afraid. You know, I was hardly recruited coming out of high school, and I was, you know, breaking records and went to a state championship game. We went to state the year before. So it wasn't like I was, you know, just came literally out of nowhere after one season. So I think just being in town and allowed to be around the guys for like 5-6 months really helped. And then I figured out that I was good enough to play right away. So I think that was a real advantage for me because instead of just getting thrown in the fire right away or showing up, you know, obviously in the fall and then maybe realizing you're not good enough or there's a skill set that you didn't work hard enough at or you know how it is. You see guys that are really highly recruited and then they get on campus and
they get
exposed. And
well, it's not just that.
Like,
yeah, I also think, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but it also they knew you could play, right? Whereas, like I remember when I showed up at Notre Dame, like, yeah, I knew I could. I had confidence, although you know we got to practice. I was a little bit overwhelmed initially, but you kind of have to reprove yourself to those guys, especially the older guys. And, you know, they're like, you know, they don't like, especially back then, they really didn't like younger guys that didn't earn their kind of credit hours. Like, I can imagine that, like, Blake Stepp and Corey Violette and Roni, when you showed up on, because you had played, and because you grew up in the area, you had some equity there. Whereas, like, when I was at Oklahoma State, like, no one knew that I could really score when I was in high school. And so, no one ever thought it was anything other than me. Like, oh, he can't shoot. That's just the deal. Whereas with you, I think automatically there was a lot more respect because they had played with you, they had seen how you play, they knew what you could do, and so you didn't have to kind of re-earn their trust. It was already there.
Absolutely. I mean, that season, my first year, we had 6 seniors, and I ended up, you know, playing 19, 20 minutes off the bench, and I think me playing so well in the summertime, like you said, it gave me the equity. Blake Stepp, Kyle Bankhead, those type of guys would tell Coach Few, like, hey, man, we got to play this kid, even though he's a true freshman and we're loaded. I mean, that was the year we went to we lost to Nevada in that second round. We were a number 2 seed in Seattle. So we were a really good college team with a lot of good players. So I think you're exactly right. When you get the opportunity to play early, you can kind of wash away the freshman aspect. And you're exactly right. It's different now. Like, kids show up now. Nobody cares that there's, you know, freshman or sophomore, and they're, you know, because there's hardly any seniors anymore. Back then, you kind of had to, it was assumed that you weren't just going to play just because you were young, you know, for the most part. So I think exactly, like you said, being around the guys, proving myself a little bit in you know, pickup and just fitting in right away really helped my transition when I first got to Gonzaga.
All right. Sure. Of that team, who is the biggest douche to you? Who is like, man, because what I remember about that, about covering you then, was that you would get in these philosophical discussions with guys, and Andy Katz and I would always talk about, like, dude, that dude is really smart and really interesting. And that's kind of the one thing about Zags is I always feel like there's other conversations outside of just basketball, whether it's music or politics or whatever. There had to be a, one of those older guys that was like, dude, shut the fuck up.
I think, and he's a good guy now, and I see him around town, but do you remember Tony Skinner?
Sure.
Our left-handed. I don't think he really liked me much when I was at campus, because I kind of took his spot a little bit that last year. I ate up some of his minutes, but I see him around town now, and you know, he's a good dude.
That's a hard one. That's like a really, really hard one that it's interesting you bring up, right? A guy who, Tony Skinner, was a senior, you know, mm-hmm. from Albuquerque, and yep. and here comes this, you know, freshman, local kid, you know, white kid coming in and takes all his minutes and takes up all the air. And like, that's a hard one to take, right? That's got to be interesting.
Absolutely. And, you know, looking back, and especially when, you know, you get older, and a lot of ex-Zags live in town and have families and are good family men and good people. It's funny because you look back and you're like, I'd probably have the same reaction if it happened to me. And it's not anybody's fault. It's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. And, you know, it happened to me in the NBA. You just get to a point where, you know, the minutes just can't come, even though you're not really a bad player per se. It just happens. So, yeah, it was a little bit tense sometimes, you know, doing like rebounding drills. And, you know, you've probably been in a situation, an older guy just wants to really knock your head off just because. Not necessarily to get the rebound or to make the play. It's to prove a point. So there were some tense times, but
I got a story for you. I got a story for you. Okay. So when I got at Notre Dame, the other point guard is Admore White. And the way it worked then, it still works this way in some programs, is, you know, like, you'd only have a freshman if you had a junior point guard, right? Like, you'd have a year space mm-hmm. in between, not recruit over guys. And anyway, so in pickup, I was the better player, although, you know, like, I went from 160 to 177. That was when creatine first came out, and I was lifting, I was yoked. So my shooting was struggling, but I was, you know, an open game. But once we got to practice, like, I struggled to play in a system, you know, like, that's just not, as the first time you're really coached and you're playing half court basketball. And we mm-hmm. did, you know, I was playing for John McLeod, and he ran, you know, kind of a true two-side motion off. I was just not comfortable, and he was kicking my ass. And we get ready for, you know, the first exhibition game, I didn't play very much. The second exhibition game, I played well, but I got in foul trouble. So we get ready for the first game. We're playing Akron, and it's my first game in Notre Dame. And I mean, one of the reasons I signed there was because they said, you know, you'll start right away. You'll start for 4 years, and yada, yada, yada. And, and I hadn't really earned the right to be a starter in practice, and I knew that, and I was really struggling with that. And we had this play. It was called X Down Glass, and I've never seen anybody run it. And basically what it is X Down was like a flex cut duck in, right? And I would fake like I was coming off a UCLA cut, come back, catch the ball, Pat Garrity would be on the weak side of the floor, set a flex pick, and then duck in, kind of like that Maryland offense, throw a low bounce pass, he'd turn.
You know, like a Paul Pierce play, kind of?
A little bit. So X down glass was, if they were fronting on the duck in, Pat Garrity would seal the guy, and you'd actually throw it off the glass, and it would bounce to him, and he'd catch and lay it in. It's like an old NBA play.
Yep.
And, look, Admore White was like bow-legged, but freaky athletic. But he kind of could be, like, the reason they brought me in was he kind of could be a turnover machine at times. And with creative passes especially, like, he was a good player, a talented player. But he hated X down glass. He fucking hated it. And, like, in practice, when we do it, we'd go through, like, he would be on the blue team, first team. I'd be on the gold team. We'd run it. And every time he'd fuck up the pass. And he'd mumble to me, like, I fucking hate that. I hate that play. So we're playing Akron. It's the first game of the season. And it's, like, the third time or fourth time down the court. John McLeod crosses his middle and index finger and points down and starts whistling. And that's the sign for X down glass because they're front and then low post. And I swear to God, I took off my sweats. I'm like, this fucker's going to throw it out of bounds. So of course, he airmails it into the band, and he gets hooked, and I played well. And he still started the next three games, but I end up, you know, beating him out and starting the rest of the year. The good thing for me was, even though AD was a great dude, I think he actually was more pissed at McLeod for calling plays that he knew he couldn't do than he was at me for taking his minutes.
Yeah. I mean, there are times when it's, you know, like you said, you feel as a freshman, you're like, man, should I be playing these minutes? And then, you know, you beat out a guy and you kind of cringe to yourself because, you know, they always tell you if you get beat out by a freshman, it's your fault. You know, it's nobody else's fault. And at least that's what my dad told me going in after I was 1 year at Gonzaga. It's like, hey, man, they're going to recruit over you. It's just how it goes, the way the cookie crumbles. So don't make sure that when somebody shows up the first, you know, 2 weeks that you kick the shit out of somebody just so they know that you're not taking their spot. So it's interesting now, though, how the dynamics with the one and dones and all that stuff with college basketball. What do you think, Doug? I mean, honestly, you watch a lot of games. Do you think the product is as good as it used to be, or do you think it's kind of got, you know, watered down?
I would say at the top, it's very much watered down. Yeah. I would say in the middle, it's not. I mean, like, look, it's interesting. Gonzaga would always take a transfer or two, and now, you know, it's grad transfers, it's four-year transfers, it's foreign kids. Though there are the occasional, you know, now you got one and duns or two and duns, you also have, you know, more 4 and 5 year guys, which is kind of honestly how we did it at Oklahoma State a long time ago. And so Gonzaga is able to, I think the product of Gonzaga is as good or maybe better, to be totally honest. Whereas I think, you know, the Kentuckys and the Dukes of the world, like, those guys are freaky talented, but they're not. There's just no way at 18, 19 years old you're going to be as good a shot maker, as smart a basketball player as you are if you've lived it for a couple of years. And,
absolutely.
You know, and so, you know, trying to find that balance. I think Kansas usually does a really good job of having the balance of one and duns and some 3 and 4 year players. But no, I don't think it's good for the sport. I don't think it's good for the NBA. I think I think that's the big thing that it's missing, is that so many in my business, or I guess our business, want the player to get paid, that we miss that it's really not that good for the product to have guys go and barely play as rookies and go into the G League. You know, like, it's just, let me ask you about you. So what about, what's your opinion? Like, people know my opinion. I have a radio show every day. What's your opinion?
I think it should be 0 or 2. And, you know, I really think if you're good enough to play, or perceived good enough to play, that you should be allowed to go right away. And then if you go to college, it should be 2. And I think kind of like what the NFL does is, you know, they do the 3 year. So everybody kind of weeds themselves out, right? And the herd kind of thins itself, and you automatically get to see if guys are ready to play. I hate the idea that college basketball is, like, really ripping people off. I think there's value in an education. There's value in walking out of a university without debt. Now, I come from, you know, my years at Gonzaga, I generated a lot of income for the university. That's just the truth, and that's not me trying to brag or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the truth. So,
let me ask you this. For the rest of your life, okay, like, you do games during the year. If you wanted to, you know, do you have a book, by the way?
I don't.
I mean,
I don't.
You could do a book. You could do a movie. right? Like your story is a book. Your story is a movie. And you're Adam Morrison. Like, yes, I guess that I get that during that period of time, they benefited financially from you. But for the rest of their life, like, you're Adam Morrison Gonzaga.
I agree. It didn't bother me is what I was trying to say. Everybody uses the idea that, you know, if you're not paying the players, like, they're obscenely getting ripped off. It's like there's only a certain amount of college players that really generate a lot of wealth for their universities. So I always looked at it as, hey, I was afforded the opportunity to come back to school. They gave me that opportunity to finish my degree because I went and finished about 6 years ago. And I walked out with no debt. And then, like you said, I'm always attached to the program. And I get to use that likeness for my own personal gain. I've made more relationships that I never would have had.
That's a big one.
Really is. Boosters, people that I would have never been able to rub elbows with, you know, in business-wise, financially. I have the opportunity for the rest of my life to do that just because of I made jump shots for 3 years for the university. So I think it should be zero or two. I really believe, you know, if you're a 16-year-old whiz kid, they're going to hire you on Wall Street if you can make them money. So why can't a kid go out and go to the NBA right away? But then if they go, I think they should go for two because one doesn't do anything for anybody. I think you just go for a semester, then you screw, you say fuck the rest of the year. So that doesn't help anybody. You're totally getting rid of the student-athlete aspect. And then for the product, how do you attach yourself to teams as a fan?
Right.
You know, it used to be, you know how it is. You'd get a good recruiting class, you'd be like, all right, maybe in 2 years we can go to a Final Four. You know what I mean? Because they're going to grow together. Now it's like, well, shit, let's hope we catch lightning in a bottle in a three-week sport, basically, and, you know, see if we can make a run with, like you said, 18-, 19-year-old kids that got 1 foot out the door, and they got an agent in their ear. So I think it's zero or two, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess my issue with the zero is that if you tell them they can go, they're all going to go, even if you go like, hey, you're going to go to the G League. Like, that's fine, I'll go to the G League. Like, look, they've actually been able to go to the G League since the G League came. No one does that because most people understand the value of, like, look at Zion and how he's benefited from the 1 year. Not just in terms of his skill and his body, but in terms of his prominence, right? Like, it does, but I just feel like they all think, I'll go to the G League and then I'll go to the league. And like, dude, you don't want to play in the G. I'm just telling you, you don't want that. Like, you want the college experience. You want the college girls. You want the college fans. You want to, you need that time in between high school and the pros. And I would generally agree with you. Like, I don't understand why there has to be a none and done. I guess the issue is there is the occasional outlier. There is the LeBron James that can do it. But that's a one in a million shot. Most of the guys need time for seasoning. And I don't know. I just always feel like college never hurt anybody. I want to ask you a couple things college-wise before I want to get to your pro experience.
Mm-hmm.
The UCLA game. I'll tell you my opinion of it. And then I want all your memories of it, and feel free to not, please don't pull any punches. I think
cool.
The national people, there's lots of dudes who always they put the picture of you crying on the court in Oakland, and to me, it couldn't be a better picture of what you were about, of what Gonzaga was about, of what the tournament's about, because, like, that's what it really feels like to lose that was your last game as a college player. And I always thought, like, people make fun of guys who cry after games. Like, well, if you don't cry, then it didn't matter to you, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you don't cry, like, doesn't matter. And it really mattered. What I remembered was, like, the MO of Gonzaga was, man, you guys were tough and skilled, but there was, like, Fuey got a reputation, which I don't know if it was well-deserved, of a guy who... You know, he's so balanced in life, but maybe not, maybe too balanced, right? He wasn't gritty enough. He wasn't nasty enough. Like, he's a preacher's kid. He's a super nice guy. And maybe that's what got exposed when they started pressing you guys and you started throwing the ball all over the gym. I don't know. But I look at back at that moment and I'm devastated for you because you guys did have a great team. You did have a big lead over a super talented UCLA team. And everyone's takeaway from that game is you sitting on the court crying when, you know, the former basketball player in me just fucking loves that because it meant something to you. And I know how quickly it's over, and that feeling of it being over is really hard. So let's go to you, UCLA game. Just go.
Yeah, I a lot of what you said I agree with. I mean, we had a big lead. You know, we were up, I think, 16 with about 5.5 minutes to go, and just really, like you said, throwing the ball over the floor. I took a really bad jump shot late against Jordan Farmer. I should have bounced him down, probably got to 8 feet and, you know, shot my little runner jump hook in the lane, might have got fouled. They had, like, 10 things that had to go right, you know what I mean? The steal, Jordan Farmer hit a running bank with, you know, end of the shot clock. And then going to the emotional aspect, you know, we thought we had a Final Four type team. I was a local kid. Obviously, there was a ton of exposure that year for college basketball and for myself and J.J. Redick. So there was all the pressure, all the eyeballs were on us. And you tell yourself, don't look ahead, but it's a little bit hard not to when you're up 15 with 5.5 minutes to go. And I think that's kind of what happened a little bit. And so it was like getting punched in the gut. It was like having your hand, you know, on the trophy or, you know, on the lead eight game, and it just being taken away from you instantly. And then you're exactly right with the emotion stuff. Every serious athlete of any worth has cried in the locker room, or like you said, they really didn't give a shit. Everybody's crying in the locker room after every loss in the tournament. That's been always been my experience. I helped coach at Gonzaga for a couple of years when I was finishing my degree, and obviously I do games on the radio every year that they lose. Guys are always emotional, and that is exactly right. It means they actually care. It was tough to swallow getting hammered, you know, personally and made fun of constantly. And that was the era right before kind of the internet went crazy. So I couldn't imagine what it would be now, you know, as far as like memes and stuff like that. But it was just really a really tough thing to swallow because we lost to Memphis that year at Memphis, and we thought we should have beat them. And so we were looking ahead, we were going to play them again,
right,
to go to the Final Four, and we knew they feared us. And I had a really good game that game. I think I had 34, played really well, liked my matchup, you know. And so we were just – it was just such a tough thing to pill to swallow. And I know that sounds cliche, but, I mean, we literally were kind of looking ahead. And then, you know, the emotion stuff, I've never been ashamed of it because it's just who I was, and I was an emotional player. I wear my emotions on my sleeve, but I would never be ashamed of being upset for putting your heart into a season and being a local kid. I mean, I was a ball boy. This was like my dream to take Gonzaga to the Final Four, or at least have an opportunity to get back to the Elite Eight, and it just happened so sudden. So it was tough for a couple of years to really think about it, to talk about it, I guess, a little PTSD if you want to go that far. But also, again, I'm not ashamed of showing emotion. That season and those memories and being in college are some of the best relationships and memories I've had as an adult. So it's something that I'll always be connected with, and I'm aware of that, and it doesn't bother me anymore, to be honest.
Michigan State game, is that your virtuoso? If, like you said, like, hey, you know, if your kids ever like, hey, I want to watch one game of you playing. That year you guys had that, I don't know, double or triple overtime. You had like 43 or something against Michigan State in the semis in Maui. Is that the game? And it doesn't have to be one that we all remember. If there's one game that you like, watch this tape, that's my favorite game I played.
I think that one is definitely up there because of the circumstances, and you know, that's obviously a big market game, and being in Maui. But I think one of the best, my greatest college game for me personally was we got beat by Illinois by like 35 in Conseco Fieldhouse, and just got our asses chewed like the whole flight home, rightfully so. I mean, we just got killed. That was not that good Illinois team with Darren Williams, Augustine, all those guys.
So this is your sophomore year?
This is my sophomore year. Then we had to come back home and play University of Washington with Nate Robinson, right. Brandon Roy, Trey Simmons, Bobby Jones, you know, really good players. And we beat them. I think the score was like 96 to 92. And it was just one of those atmospheres that was special. And it was a little gut check game. You know, we were really young that year. And it was a quick turnaround. So we kind of just had to look in the mirror. And, you know, that rivalry is pretty special around here, obviously Gonzaga and UW. And so that's the game I'd probably show my kids and say, hey, look at this one. Look at the crowd. Look how hard we were playing. You know, I played well that game, obviously. And so, you know, there's a lot of them. I mean,
I got the box score. I got the box score up. You want to know?
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right. So, you had 26 on 19 shots, 26, okay. 8 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals. Roni had 23. Derica, is it Ravio? What the hell is his last name? It changed
I called him Rav and Scrap Meat, so I mean, but I've heard him say both, so I really don't fucking know, to be honest. He's
seriously
my guy. Too.
I know, but he like changed his name like 3 times in one college career. It's really, yeah, right?
Yeah.
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 Sean Mallon had 16 in 20 minutes, by the way. And for them, Nate had 22, Will Conroy had 14. They combined
Will
for
was on it.
Yeah, they combined for 17 assists. They combined for 17 assists. They didn't make their free throws. They were 9 of 17 from the free throw line. Yeah, but those games were awesome. I always felt like you guys, I mean, that's like that's like, you know, Seattle versus the not necessarily the suburbs, but like you guys had guys from Vancouver, Washington, right? Like Ravio. You had guys from like you from Spokane. You had Canadian dudes, and Pargo came in from Chicago, right? But you guys were the, you know, Seattle has this, hey man, we got all these, you know, we got all these players that can go get buckets. I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting rivalry that unfortunately went away for a while. Now it's back, and UW is not quite there yet, but those games were always great.
Absolutely. And it was, you know, Seattle is such a hotbed too, recruiting wise, and it's Rainier Beach and Garfield, really good high school programs. And so, you know, being from the state, we always heard about how good Rainier Beach and those teams really were. So we always had a kind of a chip on our shoulder. And then it was kind of two contrasting styles. Like you said, it was usually a bunch of athletes, a bunch of guys that can get up above the rim and run. And we were kind of more of a system type team. And, you know, our rivalry, I think we won 8 straight, and then we lost my junior year at their place for the first time. That was a tough one to swallow too. But, yeah, it's a really cool rivalry. I'm glad it's back. It's fun to call too as a commentator, just because the universities are so different in a sense. Yeah. I mean, obviously there's two private schools, but the philosophies basketball wise are just so different, and it's fun to watch the two contrasting styles for sure.
Give me your best Mark Few story. Any Mark Few story at all? Just give me one.
There's a couple. There's one. After we played Stanford, you remember that Stanford team that went like undefeated and then lost in the second round that year?
Yeah.
So we lose to them in Oakland, and I have a good game. You know, off the bench as a freshman, I had like 20 or something like that, but we just got our asses. We lost by like 15, 20. And so
you only lost by 7, by the way. You lost 87-81.
But we were down 15 the whole game. Like, we shouldn't have. Yeah. Yeah.
Score not indicative of the final score.
Yeah,
of how it really played out. Okay.
So we get back on the, you know, from the flights. And this is when we had to fly commercial. So it's a long day. And we're driving up to the gym. And it's, you know, it's probably 30 degrees out, and Huey gets on the thing. He's like, all right, we're practicing right now. It's like, oh, fuck. And so we get to the gym, and everybody's kind of nervous. And every basketball player's been in that situation when you just feel the intensity and the awkwardness, and people are pissed off, but you can't really say anything. You're just waiting to see what – are we gonna just going to run lines, or are we going to beat the shit out of each other? What's going on? Everybody's tired. And he pulls me to the side, and he just – I mean – fucking rips into me. Like, you are the biggest pussy I've ever seen. You think you're Larry Bird. You're like Kiki fucking Vanderway. Like, just fucking killed me. And I'm like welling up tears, you know, like I'm 18-year-old kid. And I'm like, and I just scored 20 on Stanford, you know, on national television. Like, I played well. And he just, I mean, like, put me in my place. Like, you can't believe it. My dad was a hard ass coach, and he really taught me how to handle that stuff, but a few we got personal. So that one was a tough one, but, I mean, there's been some other ones where Derek Rabiot threw a ball up in the air one time in practice in a, you know, late-game situation. We were, you know, fucking screw-off freshman kids, so we were celebrating like we just – because we beat the first team, and the ball just went straight up in the air, and it was like a cartoon. Like, you just sit like, and he walks right into it and hits him straight on the top of the head. And it was one of those where everybody like freezes, and you're waiting for him to like cuss everybody out, and he just didn't say anything, kept walking along and kept coaching again. And it was like, holy shit, like, Derek's about ready to have to transfer right now. But
I got one for you. Okay, so because I played for Eddie Sutton. Now, this is before I got there. This is the legendary Eddie Sutton charge story. So Coach obviously he's an alcoholic. And so he was, at the time when he got fired at Kentucky, he took a year off, and then he was a recovering alcoholic. So he, you know, like, he became a big candy guy. So he always had candy in his pockets. So one of his first teams there, like, as soon as he took over, they started winning. They were his second year, they started 20-0. And I think it's the second year team. And they had Byron Houston, they had Big Country as a freshman. They had this guy named John Potter. And so some point during practice, you know, he's like, stop, you guys are so soft. Not one of you's a college man. You can't take it. Somebody run me over. I'll show you how to take a charge, right? So he plants his feet like in the middle of the lane, and all these guys are like, no fucking way. I'm not running the old man over, right? And so John Potter, he's like 6'8", probably 230. He's like, fuck it, I'll run him over. So he gets the ball, and like, our charge at Oklahoma State was like, somebody throw you a ball and you just run the dude over, right? And you're supposed to take a little contact, fall back, act like you got killed. So he takes some contact, and all of a sudden there's candy everywhere, right? Just and Potter got him, like, ran him over, and there's candy, and the managers are scrambling around like he's a pinata, right? Like, picking up the pieces of candy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, somebody, all the players, like, help him up, and he's like, dust him, said, I'm all right. He's like, now that's how you take a charge. Yeah. So there's a bathroom at the old arena before they redid it that was, like, at the floor level that only the coaches could use. So he, I got to go take a pee. And he, no one saw him for, like, 2 days after that. So I don't know if he had internal bleeding or shit like that. I remember there's a story at Indiana. Brian Evans told me that one time, you know how coaches sometimes are in the middle of practice or coaching, they got their whistle, whatever, they're yelling at you, they forget that it's transition. And so somebody misses a shot, and they got kind of get caught up in like the herd running down the court. There's some famous video of Bob Knight getting run over by like three dudes. And I guess when they had a bad day, they'd go back to some of the manager's house, and they'd all watch the film of Bob Knight getting run over and just laugh their asses just off.
Yeah, cheer up a little bit.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So you get you finish at Gonzaga. You're a junior. Was there ever any thought, let's come back? Like, you're national player of the year. You led the country in scoring. Was there ever a thought, I should come back and do it again?
There really wasn't. I even my sophomore year, I did the, you know, where you can write in, and, you know, scouts and agents give you your potential draft position. So after that year, there was, it just made sense to go. Huey and everybody tried to get me to stay. They understood. And I think it was kind of good on both sides, because everybody was getting kind of fatigued with all the attention as well. So No, I wasn't planning on coming back after that junior season.
What was the pre-draft process like for you?
I worked out for four teams, and it was good. I did all the workouts with other guys. You know, a lot of higher picks usually don't do workouts. My agent's thought process, who was Mark Bartlestein, was I look better going against guys because I don't look so good by myself because right. I wasn't super athletic, blah, blah, blah. My body wasn't great. So I worked out for Chicago, Portland, obviously Charlotte, and I think I did Toronto as well. So it went well. I felt good about all my workouts. Portland, I kind of got my ass kicked by Rudy Gay a little bit. He was a tough matchup. Just in general, he was so athletic and so long. But the other ones, I played well and felt good about him. Shot the ball well.
Whose ass did you kick?
I kicked the shit out of Rodney Carney, good dude. But I kicked the shit out of him in a Chicago workout.
Chicago drafted him, by the way. That's what's funny about.
And then I kicked the shit out of. They had a foreign kid. Because some of the guys are throw-ins too, you know, just for, you know, they'll bring in two guys and then they'll bring two more. In Toronto, I can't remember the guy's name, but I had a really good workout in Toronto, and I was actually kind of worried. I was like, well, fuck, man, like, I might be the number one pick. Like, this is going to be fucking crazy because I played so well in that workout. Obviously, that didn't happen, but the draft process is interesting because you got to be in the best shape of your life, and you don't realize how out of shape you are per se, college to NBA, until you really go through the process, and then you're like, man, I wish I would have been in this good a shape in college. I would have averaged more points, would have played better. But that's just part of the process. You give it the right trainer, and it can really elevate your game, obviously.
You know, what's interesting is I feel like it's the same when you get to college. Like, when you get to college, you're like, man, I thought I worked hard. Like, I played for a really good high school coach. He's now a junior college coach, mm-hmm. and my dad was a coach like yours. And you think you've been through hard practices, and, like, you have no idea what it's like to, like, really play hard, right? That's the thing that college brings to you, is it teaches you how to really play hard, how to really compete and practice. And then, when you get ready for the NBA, you're like, I'm in the best shape of my life. And then you get up now going, you're like, holy crap, why is this so much? And every guy you're going against is longer, more athletic, and they're in crazy good shape.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really an eye-opener. I mean, I trained with Don McLean. He still does guys. He's really good. And he got, you know, the amount of running I did pre-draft was insane. But again, it really, you know, just elevated your game because you're just, you know, you can jump higher, obviously run faster when you're in really good shape. I mean, we would shoot and then run a fucking 16, then shoot and run 2 16s, then shoot and run 3 16s. We got up to doing 8 in a practice, you know, in the course of a workout, and it was just fucking insane. But, you know, when you look back, you're like, man, why didn't anybody whisper in my ear earlier in my career? Because this would have really helped.
Yeah.
But that's the whole process is crazy, you know, because the interviews are crazy. Because you don't know really what to say, and you're a young kid, but you got to make sure that you're not looking like an idiot and blah blah blah. So,
you're a guy who likes to talk and sometimes likes to argue and stand by your. Like, did you get into any like interesting discussions or arguments with anybody, or did you just kind of let it go and play and just play nice?
I remember Scott Skiles when he was the coach of Chicago. He was funny because we were doing a workout and somebody wore a headband and he had the no headband rule. And apparently I can't remember who it was, didn't know it. And he just fucking chewed this guy out right in the middle of his workout. Like, you know, and he was like, I could literally be at lunch right now watching you fuckers, you know, like just chewing us out. And then I go have his interview with him in his office. And he was just so blunt and so like bland. I mean, I don't know him as a person. And I don't want to like kill his character or anything like that, but he was just like kind of abrasive and such an asshole, you know, and you're just sitting there like, fuck, who wants to fucking sign up to play for this guy, you know? But you know, that's how he played in the league for 15 years, short white guy, so I kind of get the mentality. But it was definitely I wasn't used to it, you know what I mean? I usually, when you're going to those type of situations, they obviously want to know who you are, but they're kind of trying to recruit you in a sense, or at least get to know you on a happy level, if that makes any sense, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you go to Charlotte. Was Jordan at the workout?
Jordan was not at the workout. Jordan wasn't even really involved until my second year is when he, I think, purchased the team or positioned himself to purchase the team. It wasn't Rod Higgins. It was Bernie Bickerstaff. I can't believe I was whiffing on his name. But, yeah, Bernie Bickerstaff was the one who made the decision to draft me. But Jordan was kind of on the outside. He was a minority owner. So mm-hmm. We'd see him every once in a while, but he wasn't as involved as he is now, for sure.
Okay, so draft night, did you know they were going to take you?
I had a good idea, but I wasn't sure. My agent told me it was either going to be Charlotte, and then I remember Nate McMillan told me in Portland, he goes, if you fall to me, I'll probably take you, which you could argue if he was serious or not, because, you know, sometimes people just say that to make you feel good. I was pretty sure that I was going to go, you know, at least six and below, for sure. It was a cool process, but also a very nervous process. And I was very shy at that time, so all the cameras and stuff really made me uncomfortable. But it was part of the gig, and, you know, I got through the night. And it was a really cool experience, obviously. It's the cliche stuff, but, you know, you end up literally winning the lottery, essentially, and you know, my friends and family are there. My high school coach was there. My dad, who coached me my whole life, was there, obviously. My sisters and my mom. So that's a really special experience. Everybody got to go to New York. It was the first time. You know, we were small-town type of people. So that whole experience was something that we all kind of look back on with, you know, very fond memories.
You show up. So you're drafted. You show up. Your first training camp, what was it like?
It was pretty good. We went to, I think, Greensboro is where we went, and you know, physically taxing. You know, I was still trying to figure out the, you know, how diabetes is going to play into the NBA game with 82 games, and, you know, just like you mentioned earlier, everybody's stronger, faster. So it was difficult at first. I thought I had a pretty good training camp, pretty good preseason that. You know, my first year, and it was Bernie Bickerstaff was more of a player's coach, so we'd go two-a-days, but it wasn't horrible. I mean, I did a training camp with Larry Brown, so I mean, it's night and day compared to what Coach Brown was like. So Bernie was cool. So, you know, just trying to get your feet wet. What was different about Charlotte was, you know, the guys before were all throwaway expansion draft guys, right? So everybody literally, I know it's pro basketball and you've experienced this, Doug, but every guy was trying to make something. Like, there was no team orientation at all. I mean, it was like everybody was either an early draft pick or they got picked up on the expansion draft. So, like, every guy, those guys had one foot out the league, and then we're all young college players. So going from Gonzaga to, you know, I got your back, blah, 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 that type of atmosphere, and then going into the pros was really an eye-opener for me. It was
it's hard.
I just was never used to that. You know, I always grew up on winning basketball teams and used to, you know, like I said, having somebody's back and playing for the betterment of the team. And you get to that situation, it's like, I'm trying to get mine, and it's definitely different.
Yeah, and that's actually my thing about the G League is,
like, it'd be horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah. It literally, the final score almost doesn't matter to most of those guys.
No,
and,
it doesn't.
And, you know, and it's like, no, literally no one wants to be there. Whereas at least in the NBA, sometimes the final score doesn't matter, but at least those guys want to be there, right? Their whole thing is they want to stick. And I just think it reinforces so many of the bad parts of a sport that we love and that we're taught a different way. As you pointed out, like, you guys start out, I think it was like one, and I'm looking right now, it's like 1-6. Your second win was, you had 27, right? You played, do you remember who it was against? It was like your first big blow-up game where you played statistically played really well? Do you know who that was against? San Antonio Spurs.
I honestly don't, man.
San Antonio Spurs.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I played it good at their place. Yeah, I remember that game. We won in overtime, I believe.
Well, you did win in overtime. The 95-92. They have, listen to who they have. They have Duncan, Parker, Ginobili, Bruce Bowen. They did start Fabrizio Oberto, but they brought Michael Finley out the bench. Like, that's a good team you went out and gave 27 to.
Yeah, I actually see Bruce Bowen every once in a while at this charity event up in Idaho, and he always, it's like, hey, do you remember that game you killed me? And then the next game we played you had 4 points. And I was like, thanks, Bruce. But yeah, I do remember that one.
You did have 4 points. You did have 4 points later on that month, and you were 1 of 10. Yeah. Wow, good memory, Bruce.
Yeah. No, like, because we beat them, obviously, at home, and I think they just won a championship the year before, and so we played them at our place, and they just came. You could tell, like, you know, certain NBA teams circle games. They circled that fucker, and they came out and kicked the shit out of us. And Bruce didn't let me get the ball, and yeah, it was a rough awakening for me the second time around. But yeah, I do remember that that San Antonio game. It was one of few good memories I've had of that season. But yeah, it was definitely fun to get a win on that floor, you know, against that type of team.
When'd you hurt your knee?
My second year in preseason. And I was closing out on the slowest motherfucker in the league, Luke Walton, who ended up being a really good friend of mine. I went to his wedding and stuff, you know, and I closed out with my left leg. I know what happened as I hurt my quad playing for Team USA going into my sophomore year, and it never healed right. And so I was always compensating on it. And that's what I think, you know, caused the ACL tear. I tore it during the preseason, and we had a good team. We had a better team that year. And my role that second year was going to be coming off the bench and probably playing 20, 25 minutes. Would have been much better for me physically, emotionally, you know, mentally, just to be able to kind of go against backups and then not play as heavy of minutes and not have as much of, you know, stress for me to score. And it was really devastating to have that injury because I really felt good. I was playing really good that preseason. So it was a tough pill to swallow. And that was the first time in my life I've ever been injured at any level. So.
What's it feel like? Because you can actually see the video online. It's your right leg, uh-huh. Right? Your left leg kind of slid a little bit, and your right leg, you plant and you go down. Did you feel a pop? Did you feel it? Like, what's the memory of it?
Yeah, it's a pop for sure. And then, you know, your leg kind of tightens up. And so once it popped, I knew something was wrong. And then I hit the deck, and then I couldn't bend my knee at all. And then it started to swell. And I think the shock of knowing that you're going to be done for the season is part of it. Because I worked really hard to try to come back better. And they really were helping me, like, hey, look, we're going to put you in this role. I think it'll be better for you. So I was feeling really good about my game. I was trying to have a nice season comeback after a decent rookie season. I averaged 11, but I didn't shoot the ball well, didn't play well. We were on a bad team. So it was tough. It was really tough emotionally. And then I was all the way out in Charlotte by myself. And it just was a dark time in my life, to be honest, basketball-wise, just to have that and then don't have the opportunity to kind of redeem yourself. And then, you know, people made fun of me for crying on the floor again. And it's just a no-win situation for me. I couldn't catch a break at that time. But that's life, and that's sports, you know. So it's so cliche, but it really builds character, and it really helps you formulate and figure out who you really are. So in hindsight, I'm thankful for some aspects of that because, you know, you find out who your friends are, you find out who really has your back.
It's interesting because you point out that the role that you really were going to evolve into was coming off the bench and just getting buckets, and that you're more comfortable with that. Whereas I mm-hmm. think, and again, some of this is your wiring, and I think a lot of it is being a coach's son, but also playing at Gonzaga, is, you know, everybody likes to have their name called and be a starter, right? That goes, even if it's fascinating to me that did you really want that role? Or was that something that you thought after you got hurt? Like when they said like, hey man, we're going to have you come off the bench, we think this is a better role for you. Were you into it then?
I honestly was. I was into it because I understood the year before of just the overall strain on my body for the 82 games. I mean, every rookie goes through that. But you know, you add on the type 1 diabetes. I mean, I was exhausted by game 50. I mean, I was literally fucking exhausted that first season by then. So my thought process was, you know, I would play 18 to 25 minutes. You know how it works. If you're playing well, you play 25. If you're not playing well, you probably play 18 or 16 or 15. But I would go against backups, and I would be the second unit kind of scorer. They'd run plays for me. And I really was honestly, truthfully into it because I thought I would be able to kind of revamp my career and make a name for myself. And it just, you know, that injury just really obviously sidelined that.
Okay, so you're going through rehab. As you mentioned, you're alone. Do you think you rehabbed well enough? Do you think if you could go back and do it, would you change it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, there would be things I would change, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I would have. I think everybody could say this, that you always, when you're done, you're like, shit, I could have worked harder.
Yes.
You know, everybody has that regret, and they always tell you don't have that regret, but
you're going to have that regret. That's
you're going to have that regret. It's almost a given, you know, with life and anything, especially in athletics. You think back, especially when you're done playing, you're like, fuck, man, I could have lifted more weights, could have got more shots up, all that stuff. There's very few guys that probably are like that, that don't have any regrets. But yeah, if I could go back, truthfully,
what
I would have rehabbed a little bit stronger, a little bit with a little more pizzazz. But I didn't really have any like guidance out there. I didn't have any, you know, teammates that were good dudes, that were like veteran type of guys that really cared about anybody else. They weren't like bad people per se, but everybody was just for themselves. And so I was really on an island emotionally and physically, obviously. So it was tough. It really was. And, you know, if I could look back, I would have probably tried to fly home maybe and rehabbed around people that, you know, you could feel that cared about you,
right,
and that sort of thing. And that would have helped me emotionally. And that usually when you're, you know, feeling good emotionally, everything reverts back to your body, power of the mind, and all that stuff. So, yeah, a little bit regret with how that year went down, definitely.
Okay, so that year, you guys were – Sam Vincent was the coach that year, right?
Yep.
Okay, so the next year you come back, and Larry Brown's the coach. And my dad grew up with Larry Brown. Like, Larry was kind of like a legend in Long Beach, New York. And I actually played for his brother, who was an NBA assistant.
Herb.
Yeah, Herb, who's, you know, who's kind of like spitting image of him. So you come back, and now you're trying to reestablish yourself with a new coach. Like, everything is different. What was that experience like?
It was very difficult, to be frank. His training camps were, he said that training camp's not a week long, it's a month long, it's the whole preseason. So actually, I think it was Jason Richardson called the league on him because, you know, they have that, you know, certain amount of time you can practice, blah, 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 you know, collectively bargained. And we were going over that. And so that was difficult. And then Larry was, obviously he's a Hall of Famer, and I'm not going to sit here and discredit like his character, but he can be kind of a not cognizant of people's emotions or how they're feeling personally. Doesn't mean you have to, it has to be a love fest when you walk into the gym. But as a coach, I feel like you have to have a sense of where a guy is at, and you can be demanding without being demeaning. And there was many times where he would be very demeaning to guys, and we would practice and practice and practice. And he would stop every fucking play and talk. I mean, every single one. So you'd be standing on the court for 3 hours sometimes, but you're like, fuck, we barely went up and down. But I'm standing here, my knees are killing me, my back is killing me. There's a lot of guys that have the same sentiment. Obviously, he's a Hall of Famer. I'm not going to, you know, say that he can't coach, but it was definitely totally opposite of any type of coach that I've ever played for in my life.
Yeah, it's interesting because oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it was such an up and down year. I mean, I obviously got traded in the later half of that season, but I had some good games. You know, with some good stretches, and then I wouldn't play for 2 weeks. And then he would do things where he wouldn't tell you that you're going to play heavy minutes tonight. And I know everybody says that you're supposed to be ready, which is absolutely true. But if you're a professional coach, why wouldn't you just tell your player that, hey, man, I might go to you tonight, you know, before the game, 3 hours before the game, and things of that nature. He just never did that. He was kind of an asshole sometimes, to be honest.
No. Listen, I played against one of the ways I got in good at ESPN. I did a year of just doing games and local radio, and then I went and played in France. I came back after a month in France, and I pitched them on, like, hey, I played against Darko twice when I was in Israel, when I was still a player.
Mm-hmm.
Played against Petrus and Diaw and Andre Kirilenko, and they're all in this draft. And I was like, dude, Darko's going to be a top five pick, and I actually played against him. And I'm telling you, I believe that Darko, and look, you know, people say, like, kind of like you, where, like, Darko was, you know, had to find himself, and Darko, you know, there was a language barrier, and, like, yeah, okay, but, and I'm with you. Like, I think Larry Brown is a great coach, but he's not for everybody. There is a fit there. And had Darko gone and played for almost anybody else or played in this era of the NBA, that dude's 6'11", could shoot, could post, could block shots. Like, he kicked. We had Monte Melicia was our center when I was in Renan on Israel. And Monte was a good player at Long Beach State. He was 25 years old. And we played Darko, and Darko was 17. He kicked Monte's ass both times. We're like, who the fuck is that? Because, like, he's 17. Like, no way. He played for Hemofrom Vrazic. And we're like, no fucking way he's 17. Like, dude, he's 17. That was, like, a year before he was going to the draft. Anyway, like, I'm with you. I understand that. And the talking thing is like, dude, enough. Like, let's go. Let's hoop.
And you can't be a screamer in the NBA. And I, you know, obviously I was lucky enough to see the other complete polar opposite when I got traded to LA with Phil. His coaching style was complete opposite, and obviously everybody knows how successful he is. So it was tough, man. Larry was an ass kicker. He really was a defensive first type coach, so I definitely didn't fit into that mold. So I was behind the eight ball, and then I was coming off an ACL surgery. So it was, you know, those years obviously allowed me to live the lifestyle that I live now, but it was also, you know, a dark time in my life to instead of a joyous one, you know. And you look back and you're like, man, that should have been a really happy time in my life. I was playing in the NBA. I should have been, you know, feeling good about myself. It was a constant struggle to feel good about myself, to play well, to make friends, to feel fit in. I mean, I was kind of a fish out of water, and it wasn't just Larry Brown, you know, but it was kind of the icing on the cake when he came in, and I just really didn't fit in with that organization anymore.
You go to LA. Who is the first? Was there any dude that was like took you and was like kind of took you under your wing or reached out to you when you get to the Lakers?
Luke Walton was just such a nice human being towards me and my family when I first got there. Because my daughter was three. My firstborn was three when I got there, about two or three years old, if my memory serves. So he really reached out and was like, hey, man, come hang out. I'll show you around. I'll drive you to practice for the first, you know, couple days until my car arrived. Just really kind of broke the ice. And then the whole locker room there was just so different, and guys were so cool and like welcoming, you know what I mean? And just kind of, you could tell they generally cared about each other. So it was really a time that it was difficult not playing, obviously, because I was a competitor and I always felt good about my game there. But I always felt content to a certain extent where I didn't have as much anger and frustration because these guys actually cared about each other. They tried to win. And so when I first got there, you could see that right away. And it definitely was a better experience basketball-wise and emotionally for me compared to Charlotte, for sure.
I remember, like, I look back and you guys played against the Bobcats, but you didn't play. Like, what's that like to sit there? Like, I'm sure in that night, didn't you want to go to Phil and go, like, dude, you got to give me some minutes here?
Yeah, I was pretty pissed off. And he actually, what I liked about Phil is he would apologize to you or tell you why you didn't play sometimes. And he did that just because. And a lot of pro coaches don't do that, and they don't have to do it. But he just told me that night, he's like, I think we lost that game. He's like, hey, I couldn't find you a spot. So that was difficult. And then getting just, you know, hearing it from the fans on the bench, it was tough to go back there. Because, you know, there was so much hype for me, obviously where I was drafted, and rightfully so. I was supposed to be a better player for Charlotte. So not living up to that was definitely difficult. But at the same time, there were some cards that didn't fall my way in certain situations. So it was a combination of both. But, yeah, it was tough because I wanted to revamp my career, obviously. I wanted to stay in the NBA. I wanted to be a part of a team. Even if I was playing 5-10 minutes a night, I wanted to be able to openly contribute besides practice time. But I just never had that opportunity, really, because we were good. I mean, the team went to the finals the year before I got there. Then the year I got traded, we win, and then we win again. So this team was already pretty much pre-built, and Mitch Kupchak just kind of took a flyer on me. And they really wanted Shannon Brown, and it really worked out for the team also.
Right.
Shannon had a good, you know, 2-3 years there. So it was a roller coaster ride of a career, you know.
What is it like to win a championship but to not play? My personal experience is, my first year, I play in Russia, and we were just put together to win the championship, and we did. We only lost one game the whole time I was there.
Wow.
And, the weird thing about Russia was when we would get a lead, they would put all the Russian dudes in, and they wanted their guys to win. And I was playing as an American that year, and it was super weird. We're playing Unix Kazan for a championship. It's like a best of three series, and I think we won all. Or maybe it was a best of five. And we won 3-0. I don't remember. I just remember that I was brought in to break the press. They would press. I'd break the press. We'd get a lead, and then I would sit out. And I just remember winning a championship, and because I had only been on the team like half to three quarters of the year, I didn't do training camp with them. I obviously wasn't Russian. There wasn't, and because I didn't play major minutes, it was my first year out of college. Like, I felt. It was like, yeah, I won a championship. And I have a buddy whose name is Joe Smith. So he's a relief pitcher for the Astros. And he won a World Series with the Cubs. And he was with the Indians in the playoffs, I think, last year. And I asked him, and like, I don't know, it's on the podcast. Who knows who's going to pick it up. But I was like, which was better? And he's like, are you fucking kidding me? I didn't pitch for the Cubs in the playoffs. Like, Joe Madden didn't use me. Like, I have a ring, but like, I didn't win a championship. It was so much better. He came up kind of with the Indians. That's where he made him. And to pitch for the Indians, even to lose, was better than to not play and to win. You're part of two championship teams. You have two championship rings. Nobody can ever take that from you. You got a chance to practice against Kobe Bryant on a daily basis and play for Phil Jackson. But what's it like now to have won two championships that you didn't get to contribute to in the playoffs?
Yeah, it's. I think you put it best. It's awkward because you know you contributed to the team, but you can't really explain that to people. And then if you do, you sound like you're reaching. And it sounds like a look at me type of thing. So you kind of have to sit there and take the abuse with no chance to defend yourself. So that part was difficult. And it was difficult just not getting a chance to go. I mean, I felt really good about my game in LA.
I thought the second year you would play more. The second year was a year after the knee injury. I remember watching you play in the preseason, and watching you move around. And I was like, dude, in the triangle, you got to be able to play multiple positions, got to be able to make shots with limited dribbles. You know, you were long enough to defend multiple positions. I was actually surprised. The second year was surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, I played summer league the year before, and I know that's kind of it can be a little bit of fool's gold, but I averaged 26 in that system and played really well going into that second year. And I finally, you know, I felt good about my game again. I felt like, hey, I can probably squeeze 10 minutes out of this rotation, maybe 15 if I start playing well. And it just didn't happen. And, you know, so then you get to the playoffs, and I mean, we had 13 guys, so I'm literally the only guy that has to sit out. So then it's broadcasted 10 times over, and then I'd get, you know, consistently mocked. I mean, it was tough. I was lucky that I had good teammates that understood and always stuck up for me as well, which I was always appreciative of, you know, in L.A. That's one thing I'll say about that organization is they treat people the right way for the most part. You know, my experience was great there. I never felt like a pariah. They never made me feel any less than anybody else just because I wasn't playing major minutes.
Yeah. I was in summer league for them. I went to two veterans mini camp and Mike Penberthy beat me out one year, and then Joe Chrisman beat me out in summer league, whatever, to get to vet camp. And Joe, they both made the team. And, but it was the same thing. Like, even for me, like, at least you were a stud. I wasn't. And they were, that's the thing about that organization was they were just like, hey, you know, you want to get a massage, get a massage. You want to come in and, you know, work out, you know, like, whatever. If you're wearing a Lakers jersey, you're a Laker. Okay. So give me your best Kobe Bryant story.
I got to make sure I'm filtering these a little bit.
Why?
You
just crushed Larry Brown. Why?
I didn't crush Larry Brown.
I know.
Everybody knows that the year that he hurt his finger, right? The second year, remember he broke like at the top of his index finger.
Okay.
On his right hand. And Kobe was the type of guy that obviously he was motivated, but he would get bored with, cause he was so good. But you know, you heard stories about all the great players that would be like, what's the highest points in this building? Or, hey, I'm going to fucking play, you know, three quarters hard and blah, blah, blah. Just make shit up to kind of motivate themselves in regular season games. And, you know, on the bus, we would always look at, you know, at the end of the games, they give you all the box scores from around the league. And we would always be like, man, fuck, did you see LeBron's line tonight? Just to kind of like piss him off a little bit and kind of motivate him, you know? And so we got in a discussion one night about who has the best left hand, and Kobe was like, I have the best fucking left hand in the league. And we're like, dude, you don't even fucking shoot left hand. Like, what are you talking about?
He goes right every time.
Yeah, we're like, everybody can dribble left-handed. You know, it's the NBA. Like, what are you, like, you're not a part of this argument. Like, because he always said he was the best at everything, even jokingly, but he was just, hey, Kobe, you want to play cards? Like, no, you guys fucking suck too much. I'd beat you. You know, let's talk. All right, whatever.
Yeah.
And we're playing that game where he injures his finger, and, you know, it's a meaningless fucking, regular season game, and he hurts his finger, like, in the first quarter, plays the rest of the game with his left hand, scores, like, 18. I mean, he's playing literally with one hand, and he checks out, and he comes, sits right next to me, and this is, like, a month after we had this conversation on the bus, and he turns and looks at me, and he goes, hey, Amo, you still think I don't have the best fucking left hand in the league? And I'm like, this guy's fucking nuts, man. Like, absolutely crazy. And then, I mean, there's plenty of other, I mean, jabs. One time I was talking trash to him and everybody was gassing me up because I had a good practice against him or somewhere, made some jumpers against him. And somebody was gassing me up. So I was just like, yeah, man, how'd you like that fadeaway? And he goes, every time you are guarding me and I catch the ball, there's a giant SOS on your fucking back. So shut, you know, and he just started clowning me. And it was, you know, we were, that's what was one of the funnest things about that team was the locker room. And I'm sure you've experienced it as well as when you can rib your buddies and it never gets personal, but it gets very close to the line. That's how it always was. So, man, he was such a competitor. All this cliche stuff about him are so true. Hardest worker I've ever seen. Toughest motherfucker I've ever seen. Wanted to win more than anybody else. Demanding. But I experienced the nice Kobe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've heard, some other stories about him kind of, really killing guys. I mean, I've heard the story about who was the guy played at Florida State that played for them? Was it Von Wafer?
Von Wafer, yeah.
I think he got him traded. Was the story I always heard based off of like a 3-on-3 game, and Von Wafer was talking trash to him, and he's like, "Well, fuck, I'll just get you traded." Like, told him, "Like, I'll get you traded," and fucking got him traded. And so, like, there was some interesting things he said that were funny because he likes, he's a good person. You know, he does a lot for the community, and he cares about people. But I think he likes being an asshole at times, too, just to fuck with people because he's a thinker. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there were some times where he would fuck with, like, the security guys that have to be around him all the time and just, kind of be an asshole to him. And you'd sit there and kind of smirk because you're just like, dude, what the fuck are you doing, man? Like, this poor guy is fucking running all over the hotel to go grab your fucking phone. Why can't you just put it in your pocket, or something like that? But
I was
lucky to be with him. He really helped me get through the season, and it was always cool with me and my family. Always. I mean, so Kobe Bryant has a place in my heart as just a competitor and somebody that could have just let me be off to the side, but he always made sure that I felt part of the team, and I was, always appreciated that.
Game 7, NBA Finals. Boston Celtics, right? Wasn't that your last game? That was your last game as a Laker, I think.
Yep.
What do you remember? What was that experience like? I mean, because that was an absolute war. I felt like Ron Artest's toughness won that game, posting up, getting some buckets. He had a bunch of steals, like 5 steals. But again, I wasn't there. I mean, I wasn't in the locker room, wasn't courtside. You were. What do you remember about game 7 against the Celtics?
I think it was, a literal street brawl. I mean, the refs didn't call anything, as they shouldn't. But I think you're right. I think Ron brought us an extra dynamic of toughness that whole season. It helped us push through. It helped Powell. It helped Lamar, obviously. And I remember just how kind of lucky we got in the sense that because Kobe played bad statistically that game. I think he was
6 of 24, 0 of 6. Yeah. From 3. But you guys did, by the way, you did shoot 37 free throws. Only 25 of 37, but you shot 37. But it was a pure 6 brawl. But yeah, he couldn't make a shot.
Couldn't make a shot, exactly. And he was, pressing the issue and forcing it. And one of our things, especially during the season, is all of our bench guys, we just yell on the sideline, like, not directly to him, but we like, fucking throw the ball to Powell. Just throw it to him. He's going to make the right decision. He's a really good player, blah, blah, blah. Cause when Kobe started to get going, obviously he's a great scorer, but sometimes he would, he would fucking, hey, man, you got to swing the basketball one time. Like, just pass it. We know you can score. We know you're a competitor. And I think he was kind of in that mindset. He was just pressing so much. But I think Ron, you're exactly right, really kind of stabilized us inside, and then he obviously made that big 3 late. And that was such an emotional game for the whole team because there was so much pressure on that team to obviously repeat being the Lakers and then going against Boston and losing to them the season, 2 seasons before the Orlando championship. So I remember guys being really happy, obviously, in the locker room, but being just more of like, fuck, it's finally over, man. I can fucking think. You know what I mean? I can relax. I can be myself. Because it was so stressful for a lot of those guys to go out there and win.
Bynum, was he just, was it his knees? Was he too goofy?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. He was a great kid. I think a little bit immature for the time, obviously. He came in the league at 17.
Can you imagine being 17 in Los Angeles as part of the Lakers?
and with a shit ton of money too,
yes.
You know, and coming from nothing.
Right.
So Andrew always worked out and always was on the training table. So when people would be upset about his knees, it used to bother me as a teammate and as a friend, you know, like, hey man, that's 320 pounds. He really can't help it. You know, his knees naturally bowed in. So he obviously had rotten luck there. But I think some of the stuff off the court, you know, with all the cars and stuff like that, was kind of off-putting to people, and I can kind of understand why. Because, I mean, this dude fucking spent, I mean, had to spend like $10 million on cars. I'm not even fucking kidding. There were $5 to $10 million. I mean, it was Ferrari. He had a Lambo. He had two Chargers. I mean, he got sued by his... Remember, he got sued by like his neighbor because he was parking all of his cars out front of his house, and that, you know, I'm sure he was in Brentwood or somewhere. I always felt bad for him because I think he was in too early, and I don't think he had the maturity level, and I don't think he had the right people to say no around him. That was the biggest issue for me, because it's easy to. Just to bring your mother along or bring somebody that's kind of your caretaker. But if they don't say no to you, then it's basically not like they're not even there. And so there was the times where I would think, man, like, how is this guy, you know, I don't know his financial situation. I'm not trying to throw somebody out of the bus, but I was just think like, fuck man, like how are you better put $5 million away and just so you can't touch until you're 55, please God, or something like that. Because he was just spending so much money on cars and stupid shit because he was so young. And then you were like, dude, your knees could give out tomorrow.
And they did. And they did.
And they did. And so I hope he's well. He's a good person, a good dude, good heart, you know, good teammate, all the stuff. It just, I think he was a little bit too immature. And like I said, you got to have people that say no to you. You got to have your financial people got to tell you no. Or you got to be not smart enough or just have enough nuts to tell yourself, like, all right, everybody knows I'm fucking rich. I don't have to keep showing it. You know, everybody already knows we are. So just buy one car and be fine with that and be happy and content with that. So I don't know.
I got a couple more here. I had drinks with Kobe, and one of his things he champions about himself, as you know, he does think he's the greatest ever. And he's like, look, before Pau Gasol played with me, everybody thought Pau Gasol was a pussy. He's like, and we won two championships with Pau Gasol, and you can't be a pussy and win a championship. What was your experience of Pau playing with him, his toughness, his intelligence? Like, what's he really like?
Pau was the most fundamental most fundamental and most precise player I've ever played with. Obviously, Kobe was the best, but Pau was, I mean, he does shit that they told you in, like, fifth grade, like, chin it to the rim every single time. Like, he was so skilled that he obviously elevated the Lakers to those championships, and he was not a pussy. He was just, you know, he's a Spaniard. I mean, there is a different culture. You know, just because he liked wine and going to the opera doesn't mean he was soft. And I think Kobe really helped him through that phase. And he really, challenged himself because he did get his ass kicked in that finals against Kevin Garnett and then redeemed himself for those two championships because he had to go against Dwight Howard. And then obviously Kevin Garnett later in that second championship run. So Pau was one of the, you know, best all around players I've ever played with, easily. Soft touch. He could shoot 15 foot left hand running hooks, could pass. He could shoot the three. And I think if he played, like if he took his prime now, he would be almost just as good or even better because I think he could stretch the floor a little bit more. Yeah. But, you know, it was more back to the basket a little bit. Even then, when I was playing, there was still a post aspect to the game. So, unbelievable player, unbelievable teammate, good dude, not a pussy, you know, just lucky to play with him. I was always in awe of just how skilled he was, I mean, honestly. unbelievable.
You went and played in Belgrade. You went and played Beşiktaş in Turkey. Was your heart in it, right? That's a hard thing to go from being, you know, the golden child of college basketball, top three pick, and then, I'm sure you wanted to play, but you're with the Lakers, right? And the Staples, winning a championship. Now you're, no matter how level it is in Europe, it's just different. There's still a hook in the locker room, right? Dude smoking in the locker room after games. Was your heart in it?
It's a very good question. I think it was more so in Turkey because my family was there. Belgrade was tough because I played for Pešić, who was legendary, who won that, I think, 99 FIBA World Cup or the championships. So he was an established legend. And this fucking guy, we would go two-a-days every single fucking day. It didn't matter. And I explained to him, hey, look, man, I'm not dogging you, but I need to, you know, I'm type 1 diabetic. Like, I need rest. I just do. And if you give me rest, I guarantee I can go out and give you, you know how Europe is. You give you 18 a night, that's like scoring 30 over there. You know what I mean? It's a different game. So that was difficult. What I was appreciative of, though, when I went over there, was experiencing the culture and understanding kind of how the world works. Because when I first landed there, my you know, guy who showed me around or whatever, my host, he drives me to the center of Belgrade, and there's that bombed out building. I said, well, what's that standing up? And he goes, you don't remember that? And he goes, that was, you know, Bill Clinton. In 99, Slobodan. Slobodan Milosevic. And so that really takes it, you know, puts you in perspective of, you know, life and things of that nature. So I was really thankful looking back what those experiences gave to me, especially, you know, obviously, like I said, Belgrade, but then also going to Istanbul and experiencing a Muslim country. You know, you get the idea that not, you know, kind of how the media portrayed Islam wasn't very good at that time period. And so experiencing that culture and understanding that most of the people are exactly like us with a few minor changes in diet and how they pray, it really helped me as a man, as a person, and see the world differently. And I know that sounds really cliche, but that's the one experiences that I was thankful for to kind of hit rock bottom, per se. Miss my family, miss United States, miss everything that comes along with this country, and be able to kind of find myself basketball-wise, because I played well in both stops, got paid well, had some great experiences, great friends. But at first, to be honest, Doug, it was tough. I mean, I almost just retired after I didn't get picked up that summer. I was almost going to say, you know, I made enough money, blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to hang it up. But that opportunity arose, and it helped me at least, you know, get some summer league opportunities after that.
All right, last things. You did summer league with the Nets. You were signed by the Blazers. Didn't play another NBA game. Mm-hmm. When you walked away, like, now we started by talking about, like, you're good now. When you walked away, what was your mental state in terms? Did you just want to get back and play one more game? Did you feel like you had a lot more basketball in you? Were you just done because your body was done? What was your mental state when you walked away?
Yeah, it was anger, frustration, you know, regret, all the negative emotions were there, and it was really tough at times. I mean, I honestly, Doug, I didn't watch a basketball game probably for a year after I retired when I was with Portland, like any basketball, like it would come on and I would change it.
Yep.
And this is, you know, I grew up in a basketball household, and that part was definitely odd for me. What really kind of helped the healing process for me emotionally was I was lucky enough to be able to help out the high school I coached at with the coach that I played for. Mm-hmm. And he just invited me. He's like, hey, man, just come help these kids out, or just show up and do whatever you want. And that kind of helped bring back, you know, a little bit of the joy. But it was tough. I mean, honestly, because it was, you know, everybody looks at you as a failure instantly. And, you know, people have said things about me and about my character and stuff, like I'm some pariah or some bad dude. I've never been in trouble in my life. I've never hurt anybody. I've never done any of those things. Maybe I'm a little bit quote unquote odd, but I'd rather be odd than just fucking square normal. So it was tough. It really was. It was a dark place in my life, because I went through a relationship change, basically got divorced, even though I wasn't married. I had two kids. So there were some dark times. And what? Then basketball was kind of the cognizant or the reason for those dark times. But I was lucky enough to be able to, like I said, help coach. And then Gonzaga allowed me to go back to school and help coach there. And then I slowly started to fall in love with the game again. And then, you know, now, obviously, I call games for Learfield. And then my daughter plays. And so I get the joy. My cup is filled again with basketball, which makes me feel good, obviously, because it's a sport that I've always loved and I always will love. And it's brought me to places around the world. I've met people I've never met before. All the stuff that comes along with being a professional athlete, and it's because of basketball, obviously. So it was tough, though. I'm sure you've dealt with it a little bit.
I'll give you mine on a lesser level, right? Like, so okay. I was a high school American. I go to Notre Dame. I get in trouble. I sit out a year. I go to Oklahoma State, but I can't watch myself play at Oklahoma State because I got to where no one thought I could shoot. I didn't think I could shoot, and so guys wouldn't guard me. So I still, like, part of me is like, hey, I must have been really fucking good to not be able to shoot at all, and the team couldn't function without me on the court. But that's hard to relate to somebody who doesn't understand the sport or wasn't there, right?
Yeah.
And so when I finished playing, like, I knew I could play in the NBA. I knew it because I'd kind of broken through some of those mental things when I was playing overseas. But I went, when I was first at ESPN, like, I didn't pick up a ball for about a year, year and a half. They'd all pick up ball, whatever. Like, I didn't like it. I covered it, and I liked covering it, but I felt like it was potential that I did not truly tap into. It's a really hard experience. It's like you said, like, you go back and you thought you worked hard, and you're like, damn, when I was in college, like, I'd hang out. My girlfriend became my wife. Like, man, I should have just lived in the gym and fixed my jump shot, and I'd be in the NBA. But all that path takes you to where you are now, which may actually be a better place than had you been an NBA player. And for me, or had you been an NBA star for you, you might not have been in the mental state to where you appreciate everything. Is that fair?
Absolutely right. You know, it's tough times create character and you know, all the cliche stuff that goes with it, but it really is true. You find out who your friends are. You find out, you know, what your true, you know, what really makes you happy, because, you know, when you're a star in college and in the NBA, you know, it's usually all the plastic stuff that usually matters. And when that stuff is taken away and you're quote unquote normal, I guess, which is, I don't like using that term.
Terrible word.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But it can be really difficult, to put your life in perspective in a positive way, to be able to, tell yourself, like, hey, it's okay that you're not, you know, a superstar. You didn't make $100 million. You still have these life experiences. You still have these connections. In my perspective, I get to call games for Gonzaga.
Dude, forget all that. Let me give you my perspective, okay? You're a coach's kid from nowhere, Washington. You became the biggest star in college basketball. You led the country in scoring. You're National Player of the Year, and you're the number 3 pick of the NBA draft, okay? There are 550 high school basketball players every year. You were the third pick of an NBA draft, right? There you go. You won. You won. Everything else is icing on the cake.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it was difficult at times to really believe that message in myself. But, you know, having kids really put life in perspective too. I don't want to get too sappy. You know, we're supposed to be talking basketball, but honestly, just having kids, it gives you a purpose. It gives you a different direction. It gives you a reason to get yourself out of that mental state and be healthy and be positive and be happy. And then once they start getting older, you get to share the joy of what this sport brought to be. So it was definitely 4 years, 5 years of a lot of pain and anguish and frustration, but there was also a lot of good memories as well.
Adam, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining me, sharing with me where you are now. Can't wait to, I want to do this again and not talk about you and just talk about, we'll pick up basketball and life in general. Great to know you're in a good place and look forward to talking hoops with you in the future.
All right, Doug. Again, man, I appreciate you having me on, giving me the opportunity as well.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
Hey, my thanks to Adam Morrison, and thank you for listening. Remember, listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, weekdays 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. Make sure you tell a friend or tweet at a friend or share this with a friend so they can download, subscribe, and rate our podcast. Make sure you rate. It's better for me when you rate us. It's also better for me when you get friends to subscribe to us. And I appreciate you listening. Hopefully you enjoyed it. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.